Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Hi, this is Cale Clark. Welcome once again to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. This is part three of our series called War and Peace. In light of the conflict between Russia and the Ukraine, as Russia has invaded the Ukraine, without pretext, in no way is this a just war. A lot of people are asking questions about what does the church teach about just war. And so, as background for this, we've been looking at what the Catechism says specifically about the commandment, the fifth commandment, do not murder. That is very much in the background of its teaching on just war, which we're going to get into. We're going to get to that. And so we looked at in the last episode, and if you missed one, of course, you can download the podcast. We talked about the commandments of the Lord, kind of amplifying the fifth commandment when Jesus says, you shall not murder, and adds to it in Matthew chapter 5, this is the Sermon on the Mount, prescriptions against hatred, anger, and taking vengeance. He talks about loving enemies, going above and beyond. And of course, Jesus himself did all of these things, forgave those who killed him. And in fact, even when he was arrested, he told Peter to leave his sword in its sheath, you know, to put his sword back, don't try to defend me. So Jesus didn't defend himself. So a lot of people are asking, does the church say, what about me? You know, what about nations? Is there a legitimate defense for us, even though Jesus himself chose not to do that? Well, there is. But before we get into that, let's look at what happened with Jesus on the night of his arrest. And this is detailed in Matthew's gospel. This is the gospel I'm going to select this from. This is Matthew chapter 26. And in verse 51, it says, suddenly one of those, and this is in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus is being arrested here. Suddenly one of those with Jesus put his hand on his sword, drew it, and struck the slave of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Now, in Mark's version of this, he refers to one of those standing by does this, but Matthew tells us, hey, it's actually one of the disciples. And we know, of course, that it is, in fact, Peter. We know this from Luke's gospel, his version in Luke 22, verse 50. Now, what was really going on here is that Peter was probably trying to kill this guy. It's not as if he just said, oh, can you just hold still for a minute while I slice off your ear as if with a Ginsu knife, you know, you might have seen in infomercials. No, he was taking a swipe at this guy. He was probably trying to split him in half. There's many mentions of the verb for strike, you know, to strike with the sword. And it kind of has that connotation in other verses in the Bible. But Jesus says, of course, put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Now, where is he getting this from? Where is he kind of quoting scripture here? Well, he's probably quoting Isaiah chapter 50, verse 11. Now, it doesn't read like this in your English Bible, but in the synagogues of Jesus' day, in the Old Testament readings, they would use something called the Targums. The Targums were Aramaic paraphrases of the Old Testament. Now, of course, the street language that Jesus and his disciples spoke was Aramaic. Now, of course, the Old Testament was written in Hebrew, but there was kind of a street language version, I guess you could say a contemporary version of the Old Testament that was read in the synagogues. And this is what it says in Isaiah 50, verse 11 in the Targums. Behold, all you who kindle a fire, who grasp a sword, go, fall in the fire which you kindled, and fall on the sword which you grasped. So Jesus also might be alluding to Revelation 13:10, for example. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. There's also a Jewish writing called Joseph and Asenath. It's not in the Bible, but in that writing, Levi, of course, one of the patriarchs, he prevents Benjamin from slaying the son of Pharaoh who was wounded. He says, now put your sword back into its place and come and help me, and we will heal him of his wound. And so that all of this stuff is kind of in the background of Jesus' saying. And of course, we know from Luke's gospel, he does heal the guy, puts his ear back on. And Dr. Luke is just amazed by this. He's like, wow, how did he do that? And of course, Jesus says, he continues on and says, do you not think that I can appeal to my Father and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? Angels were warriors in the Jewish mindset and also in early Christianity. There's actually a Jewish writing, 2 Maccabees 3:26. Angels prevent this guy named Heliodorus. He was trying to loot the temple. He was an agent of the king, the evil king, and he tried to loot the temple. And two young men, these are angels, but they're described as two young men. Two young men also appeared to him, remarkably strong, gloriously beautiful, splendidly dressed, who stood on each side of him and scourged him continuously, inflicting many blows on him. So these angels basically beat the snot out of this guy. And so that's the kind of thing that's in the background when Jesus says, I could call for angels to defend me here, and they would wipe all of my enemies out. Believe me. Now, why 12 legions? Well, the legions, of course, the Roman army was divided by legions. But Jesus has 12 disciples. And they were acting pretty lame at this point. They all deserted him. They were going to run away, all except for John. And so 12 legions, maybe I could do better with 12 legions of angels than you 12 disciples, but I'm stuck with you guys, and this is the way it is. So they all deserted and fled at that moment. And so Jesus didn't defend himself. He could have, but he didn't. So what about you and me? And what about nations who are under attack? Can we legitimately defend ourselves? Well, the answer is yes, we can. Let's turn together to the Catechism of the Catholic Church. If you have your catechism, you can pick it up and turn to paragraph 2263. Paragraph 2263 of the Catechism. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. Let's see what it says here about legitimate defense. It says, the legitimate defense of persons and societies is not an exception to the prohibition against the murder of the innocent that constitutes intentional killing. Okay, so clearly that's wrong here. The Catechism is saying this is not about the murder of innocent people. That's always wrong. We talk about legitimately defending ourselves. Goes on to give a little quote from St. Thomas Aquinas from the Summa. Here's what he says. The act of self-defense, this is St. Thomas Aquinas talking, the act of self-defense can have a double effect: the preservation of one's own life and the killing of the aggressor. The one is intended, the other is not. End of quote. So this is the principle of double effect, an unintended consequence. And defending your own life, trying to preserve that, you might kill an aggressor. Even though that's not your intent, you didn't look to kill somebody today, someone is attacking you in self-defense, that person might die. So that's what's kind of going on here. So this is a legitimate defense. All right, let's look at the next paragraph of the Catechism, paragraph 2264. It says, love toward oneself remains a fundamental principle of morality. Therefore, it is legitimate to insist on respect for one's own right to life. That's an important point that the Catechism is making here. We do fight for the right to life. The pro-life movement is getting stronger and stronger every day. But we can't forget about the fact that we ourselves also have a right to life. And we have to love ourselves. This is the great commandment. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And love your neighbor as yourself. You do have to love yourself too. And part of that is looking to preserve your own life. Catechism goes on here. Someone who defends his life is not guilty of murder, even if he is forced to deal his aggressor a lethal blow. And Catechism also kind of quotes another paragraph there, paragraph 2196. And again, this is Jesus talking about the commandments. The first is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this, You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. And Jesus said this in a lot of different places, Mark 12:29-31, you can find it. It's based on Deuteronomy 6, Leviticus 19. Paul also reminds us of this. Paul says, He who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not kill, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment are summed up in this one sentence, You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. He said this in Romans chapter 13. And St. Augustine once said, Love God and do what you like. If you love God, you're automatically going to love your neighbor too. And you can kind of do whatever you want because you're not going to do anything that's going to break God's law. Well, once again, part of loving God, loving your neighbor, big part of that is loving yourself as well. You're listening to The Faith Explained. I'm Cale Clark. So another quote here is given in the Catechism, another quote from St. Thomas Aquinas from the Summa Theologiae. He says this, quote, If a man in self-defense uses more than necessary violence, it will be unlawful. Okay, so you could go nuts. You could go nuts in self-defense and do more damage than what is warranted. And Aquinas goes on, okay, if a man in self-defense uses more than necessary violence, it will be unlawful. Whereas if he repels force with moderation, his defense will be lawful. Nor is it necessary for salvation that a man omit the act of moderate self-defense to avoid killing the other man, since one is bound to take more care of one's own life than that of another's. So this is an important point by Aquinas. Now, we've got to use proportionate defense, proportionate self-defense. And he says, basically, don't worry about your salvation if in defending your own life, you happen to end the life of the aggressor. Because you have to, you're actually in the sort of hierarchy here, you have to take care of your own life more than another's. Now, that might sound weird to us, but it's a little bit like when you're on an airplane and, you know, the instruction about the oxygen masks, you've got to put on your own mask first before you can help someone else. Preserving your own life. If you're dead, you're of no use to anyone else. This guy is trying to kill you. This person is trying to kill you. You have more than enough right to defend your own life in that state that Aquinas is talking about. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. It starts with loving yourself according to Aquinas. Okay, let's continue on with the catechism here. Let's look at paragraph 2265. It says, legitimate defense can be not only a right, but a grave duty for one who is responsible for the lives of others. So, for example, a police officer or even a parent trying to protect one's children. Goes on to say, the defense of the common good requires that an unjust aggressor be rendered unable to cause harm. For this reason, those who legitimately hold authority also have the right to use arms to repel aggressors against the civil community, entrusted to their responsibility. All right. And then it also mentions, links to another paragraph, 2240, and it says, submission to authority and co-responsibility for the common good make it morally obligatory to pay taxes. So no tax evasion, folks. It's morally obligatory, according to the catechism. Tax time's coming up, so pay attention. It says also that it's morally obligatory to exercise the right to vote and to defend one's country. And this is what St. Paul says in Romans chapter 13, verse 7. And this is a great, good, really good chapter to read about the civil authorities and what to do there. He says, Paul, pay to all of them their dues, taxes to whom taxes are due, revenue to whom revenue is due, respect to whom respect is due, honor to whom honor is due. And the Catechism also quotes from an early Christian document that's really important. Maybe you've heard of it, maybe you haven't. It's called the Letter to Diognetus. And it's a great example of what was going on in the early church. And it says, Christians reside in their own nations, but as resident aliens. That's a great way to look at our lives. We are resident aliens. Yes, we live in this world, but this world isn't our true home. Heaven is. It goes on to say, they participate in all things as citizens and endure all things as foreigners. They obey the established laws, and their way of life surpasses the laws. So noble is the position to which God has assigned them that they are not allowed to desert it. That's an interesting way to look at our life in this world. You know, we've been posted here. It's like our commanding officer, Jesus, has posted us wherever we happen to be. And we don't have a right to desert. We can't just check out. We've got to stay here and provide witness. And we've got to go above and beyond the laws. This person writing about the early church, wow, their established laws, that are there in society, the Christians go above and beyond this. So it's a real witness to their neighbors. St. Paul also says in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2, he's basically saying you've got to pray for kings, for everybody in authority. Why? So that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life, godly and respectful in every way. So if there's peace in society, if we are free from aggression and unjust war, that's a good situation for the spread of the gospel. Now, even in a situation of wartime, the gospel can still be spread. It's unchained. And the kindness that is shown to victims of war, to refugees, that can also be a great witness to the gospel as well. Let's go on now to paragraph 2266. It says, the efforts of the state to curb the spread of behavior harmful to people's rights and to the basic rules of civil society correspond to the requirement of safeguarding the common good. Legitimate public authority has the right and the duty to inflict punishment proportionate to the gravity of the offense. Punishment has the primary aim of redressing the disorder introduced by the offense. When it is willingly accepted by the guilty party, it assumes the value of expiation. That's kind of interesting, that when the one who has committed the crime against humanity or against people in society, if they get punished for this and they assume this as, okay, this is my just deserts for what I've done, I can kind of expiate my guilt through this. I can expiate my sin in a certain way by taking part in this punishment, this temporal punishment. Catechism goes on to say, punishment then, in addition to defending public order and protecting people's safety, has a medicinal purpose. As far as possible, it must contribute to the correction of the guilty party. And then as an example here, Luke chapter 23 is given. And so we can look at other paragraphs in the Catechism. Paragraph 1897, 1898, it says that human society can be neither well-ordered nor prosperous unless it has some people invested with legitimate authority to preserve its institutions and to devote themselves as far as necessary to work and care for the good of all. And by authority, one means the quality of virtue which persons or institutions make laws and give orders to men and expect obedience from them. Every human community needs an authority to govern it. The foundation of such authority lies in human nature. It is necessary for the unity of the state, and its role is to ensure as far as possible the common good of the society. So there has to be some authority in society. One of the interesting verses in the Old Testament in the time of the judges is that everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Well, that's a recipe for disaster in most cases. I mean, if the virtue of the people, if you live in a land where everyone is a saint, then it's not a bad deal at all. If everyone does what is right in their own eyes, because they're going to choose the good, as St. Augustine talked about. But given the fact that we live in a world where original sin is a reality, it's the only doctrine of the church that you can prove by walking down the street. As G.K. Chesterton said, sin happens. It's out there. We do need laws. We do need competent authority. And again, as St. Paul says, these authorities, the idea of authority has been structured by God. And so in some ways, this is God's will for us. But this idea of, yes, if there is a punishment, if as far as possible, it must contribute to the correction of the guilty party. God never gives up on anyone until the very end. This thief on the cross is always a great example of that. Conversions, as unlikely as they may be in some cases, can happen. Now we come to a very tricky part of the catechism, and this has to do with the death penalty. Is it possible that the church does allow for this in certain cases? Well, if you've been following the news in recent years, you know that Pope Francis is against the death penalty across the board. He says there's never a good reason for it. In paragraph 2267 of the catechism, let's see what it says here. Assuming that the guilty party's identity and responsibility have been fully determined, the traditional teaching of the church does not exclude recourse to the death penalty. If this is the only possible way of effectively defending human lives against the unjust aggressor. If, however, non-lethal means are sufficient to defend and protect people's safety from the aggressor, authority will limit itself to such means, as these are more in keeping with the concrete conditions of the common good and more in conformity with the dignity of the human person. Today, in fact, as a consequence of the possibilities which the state has for effectively preventing crime by rendering one who has committed an offense incapable of doing harm, without definitively taking away from him the possibility of redeeming himself, the cases in which the execution of the offender is an absolute necessity, quote, are very rare, if not practically non-existent, end of quote. Now, that last little quote there in the catechism is from St. John Paul II. And St. John Paul II basically said that, look, he didn't necessarily take away the moral laicity, if you will, of the death penalty, but he did say there's almost really no situation in the modern world where you'd need to use it. We can keep people locked up, keep dangerous offenders away from the public indefinitely, and there's really no reason ever to use it in his mind. Well, as you can imagine, in recent years, there's been a huge firestorm of debate about this, about Pope Francis and how he wanted to change the catechism's teaching on capital punishment. I just want to give you another view on this, and this is by Edward Fesser. Edward Fesser wrote a book, along with another author, it's called By Man Shall His Blood Be Shed, A Catholic Defense of Capital Punishment. And he wrote this book, and it's a very long, very detailed book, heavily footnoted, because Pope Francis seemed to be going against two millennia of clear scriptural and Catholic teaching on this issue. In fact, the Vatican announced that the Catechism of the Catholic Church will be changed to declare the death penalty to be inadmissible, given, quote, the inviolability and dignity of the person as understood in the light of the gospel. And as Edward Fesser points out, there has always been a disagreement among Catholics about whether capital punishment is in practice the best way, morally speaking, to uphold justice and the social order. But he notes also that the Church has always taught, consistently and clearly throughout history, that the death penalty is in principle consistent with natural law as well as the gospel. And he argues that you could go all the way back to Genesis chapter 9, all the way through to Romans 13, and this is the chapter that I referenced earlier from St. Paul, and a lot of different points in the middle. And the Church says that Scripture cannot teach something that is morally in error. Also, the fathers of the Church taught that capital punishment was morally licit, even though some of them personally opposed it in practice. The doctors of the Church also taught that capital punishment is, in fact, consistent with natural law and the gospel. We're talking about St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Alphonsus Liguori, who is perhaps the greatest moral theologian in the history of the church, St. Robert Bellarmine. And he talked about Bellarmine talked a lot about how church teaching applies to political situations of modern times. It was also taught by all popes, up to and including Pope Benedict XVI. In the Roman Catechism from St. Pius V, the Catechism of Christian Doctrine, which was put forth by Pope St. Pius X, the 1992 version of the Catechism, the 1997 revision of the Catechism that was put forth, both of those, the original and the revision, was from, of course, John Paul II. And we already talked about him just a moment ago. St. John Paul II was opposed to applying capital punishment in practice, but he did say that, you know, it was still in there as in terms of the moral teaching of the church. Pope St. Innocent I, Pope Innocent III, they taught that capital punishment, accepting that in principle, is a requirement of being an Orthodox Catholic. Pope Pius XII endorsed the death penalty on different occasions. Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who of course became Pope Benedict XVI, once said this in 2004. He's talking about this whole issue of capital punishment. He said, quote, "If a Catholic were to be at odds with the Holy Father on the application of capital punishment," now remember, the Holy Father at the time was JP II, he didn't think that there was ever any reason to apply this. "If a Catholic were to be at odds with the Holy Father on the application of capital punishment, he would not for that reason be considered unworthy to present himself to receive Holy Communion. While the Church exhorts civil authorities to exercise discretion and mercy in imposing punishment on criminals, it may still be permissible to have recourse to capital punishment." We've got to leave it there for now, but we'll talk a little bit more about this in our next episode of The Faith Explained. We're going to talk about the church's magisterium. Can the magisterium, the teaching office of the church, actually change this teaching? This is all in context and all part of our wider discussion about church teaching on war and peace. If you missed an episode, you can go to the Faith Explained archives. You can download the podcast wherever you get your podcast. Now, if you use Apple Podcasts or Spotify, I'd ask that in your kindness, if you wouldn't mind giving us a good rating and a review, if you like it. I'm not telling you how to rate us, but that helps people to find the podcast when you rate and review it on Apple and Spotify. You can also get the podcast, of course, at relevantradio.com and the Relevant Radio app. I'm Cale Clark for The Faith Explained. We'll see you in the next episode. God bless you.